The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This week's portion is Tetzaveh. This is the second in the series of portions that deals with the Mishkan, the tabernacle, creating the tabernacle, etc. And came across a very interesting topic. Okay, you know, you have events in your life that sort of give you the chance to appreciate, I guess, perspective and priorities. We get so wrapped up in the details of life. Every once in a while, you need a healthy reminder of what the really important things are. This past Sunday, I went to a memorial service at Har Herzl, at Mount Herzl Military Cemetery, for a boy from Efrat, son of good friends of mine, who was killed 30 days ago in a terrible accident. You may remember that we dedicated the weekly bite to his memory, Yosef Yitzchak Goodman. And the stories about this boy over the last month that have been circulating around Efrat have just been legendary. I mean, just unbelievable the things that this boy was capable of doing physically, how he helped his comrades. And I thought, like, I had a sense of, you know, who he was and whatever. And, you know, it's been a while. I mean, I've been out of the regular army for a long time. And then you go back to Mount Herzl, and it all hits you. You know, that's a... I actually went with my brothers. And my older brother, like me, he was in paratroopers. He also has some good buddies that are buried there. And it's difficult to go back there, and especially to go back there for a military funeral. And the commanding officer, this boy was in a very special and elite unit. And the commanding officer, the battalion officer, at one point he got up to give a eulogy. And he said, "I just want to tell you one story about Yosef, because to me that says it all," right? He had noticed Yosef as a soldier through various stories that had come to his attention. And he kind of kept an eye on him from time to time. He felt that he really stood out above the rest. He had actually been almost kicked out of course, Makim of Commander School. And they had a special vada, like a committee of high officers, to decide whether to kick him out of this elite unit. Turned out that what had happened was that they were doing Krav Maga, you know, sort of self-defense. And one of the boys from another unit, right, because you go to a special base to do that, had sort of, you know, taken the self-defense lesson a little too seriously and smashed one of Yosef's buddies from his unit. So Yosef was sort of quick to jump in the ring and defend the honor of his unit, and he basically took this guy apart. And it came to the attention, the officers weren't so amused, and so they brought it up before a disciplinary board or whatever it was. But, you know, in this particular elite unit, because of what they do that I'm obviously not going to talk about on the phone, you know, as much as they had to discipline him, they were also amused by it. And you could see that this boy just had a lot of energy and was willing to stand up. And so the battalion commander kind of noticed this, and they let the boy stay in the unit, and he kept an eye on him. Anyway, he made it through the course, and when you finish, you know, you do like regular training, and then you go to this special elite training. When he finished the whole course, the last stage of this course, of this, and it's a long, it's like a, you know, almost 2 years of, you're already a sergeant when you finish this elite commando, is that you climb this mountain, whatever, deep in the desert in the Negev, and it's a very high, very steep mountain. And when the boys get to the top, the entire unit, you know, all the guys, because these are just the newest guys in the unit, the entire unit is waiting on the top of the mountain. And it's one of those rarest of ceremonies. There are no civilians allowed. It's just for the guys in the unit. And they have fireworks, and it's like a big thing, you know, and it's a big simcha. Everybody celebrates. And the final stage is that they get their pin, right? Next to the paratrooper's wings on the other side on your sort of breast, you wear very special commando wings on your uniform. And they have a tradition in this particular unit that they take off like the covers of the needles that kind of hold the pin, and they put it on your chest and they just slam it into your chest. And it's like, you know, make a man out of you, one of those silly man traditions that hard to explain outside the army. And so this battalion commander is saying that he always notices how guys receive their pin. Some guys come up and they're like a little nervous because they've heard stories about this, and it's like, you know, sticking two needles into your chest. And some guys come and they're sort of like, you know, they're going to tough it out, whatever. And Yosef Yitzchak came up and he opens up his shirt and he sticks out his chest and he goes, "Nu, You know, let me have it, right? Like with eager anticipation. And when you, after they give him the pin, so he holds out his hand and he just, you know, there's like a handshake, right? And different guys do it different ways. Now what this Magad, what this battalion commander didn't know was that, Yosef had told his, one of his buddies, he said, or sorry, his officer, you watch when the battalion commander shakes my hand. Cause I'm gonna give him a handshake that he's never gonna forget. And this Yosef was a, well, he was a big guy, and he was very well built and physical or whatever, and marathon runner. And, the battalion commander was smiling at Herr Herzl over the, you know, the monument as he recalled this experience. And he said, I can still feel the handshake. He, you know, the crushing of the hand, you know, on my hand to this day, right? And he finally had to tell Yosef, okay, you know, you're dismissed, right? Because, and I was sitting there looking at this sort of, you know, listening to this story and looking around, and it was a very Israeli experience. There were no, you know, foreigners, no tourists. It was just guys from his unit and guys like me. And you looked at the guys in his unit, young boys, 18, 19, 20 years old, every one of them like an ox or a rock, right? And you just take a step back and you realize, like, on the one hand, what a gift it is that there are boys like this that are willing to do that. And you also realize, sort of, you know, how different, how we get stuck in the minutiae, in sort of the little details of what we think are the things that are important. And then you take a step back and you realize, you know, priorities sometimes need adjusting. Now, why do I tell you this whole story, right? Because if you look at the beginning of this week's portion, Tetzaveh, there's a very interesting pasuk, very interesting verse. It says, "Va'asita bigdei kodesh, and you shall make holy clothes le'aron achicha, for Aaron your brother, lechavod u'tifaret, for respect and for beauty." Okay? In other words, you're supposed to make special clothes. They're called the bigdei kuna, the priestly clothes, so that the priests can wear these special clothes, you know, when they do their service in the temple. And it's interesting that in addition to all of, you know, the details about, you know, the priestly clothes in terms of how many pairs of this and how many pairs of that and how they're made and who wears them and when you wear them and what their measurements are and what colors they are, right? And those are very important, right? It's interesting that based on this verse, right, if a person is if a priest is doing service in the temple, and he's missing one of these articles of clothing, then his entire service is considered null and void. It's a complete waste of time. It's like he's done nothing. And that, by the way, is true not only if he's missing a piece of clothing, but also if he adds a piece of clothing. You know, I have this image of them rebuilding the temple, and, you know, they're like teenage kohanim, teenage priests who get to go serve in the temple. And so one of these kids kind of forgets to take his baseball hat off. And he does everything he's supposed to do. He offers up the sacrifices and he offers the incense and he has the right intent. He does everything, but he's got a baseball hat on his head. The whole avoda, the whole service is completely null and void. Right? That's what the Rambam points out. In fact, if a person does this on purpose, right, he's liable to death from heaven. Mita bidei shamayim. And not only is that the case in terms of if he's missing clothing, but even if the clothing is stained or torn, okay? If a guy has a tear in his clothing, the special priestly clothing, and he does the avoda, right? That the high priest on Yom Kippur goes into the Holy of Holies, does exactly what he's supposed to do, and the entire forgiveness of the Jewish people is based on this service, but he doesn't notice that he has a big sloppy pizza stain, the entire avoda, all of the service that he did is null and void. He has to do it again, and in this particular circumstance, he couldn't do it again because there's only one Yom Kippur, right? So you're done. Now, that's incredible. And there are really two problems with this particular idea. The first problem is, well, why is it so important to be so specific about the clothing? I mean, I would think that what's important is what's inside, not what's outside. You know, a guy walks into synagogue and he's wearing jeans and a ripped t-shirt, so I know who this boy is. I know what's in his heart. I know what's in his soul. He may be the purest one in the synagogue. Why do we put such an emphasis, such a focus on the externals? Right? And then, of course, there's a second question, which is, you know, at least in terms of this first question, I understand you could make a case for saying that, you know, if you're participating in an experience that's special, that you create special rituals in order to demonstrate how special that experience is, right? Every Shabbat, so we wear special clothing for Shabbat. I don't dress like I do during the week. I wear Shabbat clothes. And in fact, there's an interesting story that came out of this year's Nobel Prize Awards, Nobel Ceremony, because everybody knows that there was a professor of economics from Israel, a religious Jew, whatever that means, who was awarded the Nobel Prize for Economics. And what's interesting is when he got the invitation, so part of that invitation tells him that he'll be given a special uniform, a tuxedo, basically white tails, to wear at this ceremony, at the dinner afterwards, I don't know, whatever it is. So he's a religious Jew, so he got a little nervous because he said, you know, I have to check it for shatness. I have to know if there's wool and linen, because if there's wool and linen in a garment, then biblically speaking, we don't wear that garment, right? To this day, I check my suits when I buy a suit so that I shouldn't wear shatness, right? Wool and linen. So, you know, they didn't know what he was talking about. So anyway, he negotiated with them, and eventually they checked the garment. Sure enough, there was shatness in the garment. There was wool and linen in the garment, right? And because of that, he decided to order his own set of tails, exactly according to their specifications, from Israel, and bring it with him that was shatness-free. And that was incredible. And I understand that there are ceremonies and we have special clothing, so I can get my hands around the fact that there's special clothing, and I can even get my hands around the fact that maybe, you know, that there's a message to be said that the way in which we relate to God and the way in which we relate to mitzvot, that we should make them beautiful. And in fact, that may be the idea behind this verse, that when you do a mitzvah, don't just do the mitzvah, but make it beautiful, right? The only problem with that is that we actually have another verse, and that other verse is the source for the fact that you're supposed to beautify a mitzvah. And that's actually in the portion of Bishalach that we read a few weeks ago, just at the beginning of Shirat Hayam, the Song of the Sea. It says, Zek Keli V'Anvehu, this is my God, and I will beautify him. And the Talmud in Shabbat, in 133, right, Kuflam Gimel, says, you know, based on this verse, Hitna'elefanav b'mitzvot, that a person should beautify himself before God with mitzvot. And this is the source that there's actually a mitzvah to make a mitzvah more beautiful. In other words, like I could walk into synagogue in the morning with my tefillin in a paper bag. But you don't put tefillin in a paper bag. Now, if you put tefillin in a paper bag, you could still wear the tefillin, but you should make a beautiful case for the tefillin, right? You know, we make beautiful mezuzot. We put a beautiful me'il, like a sort of a cloth, almost shirt, as it were, for a Torah scroll, right, and so on and so forth, right? You don't light candles, you know, with a wick inside a paper cup of oil on Shabbat, you know, on Friday afternoon, you light them in beautiful candlesticks. And there's a biblical basis for this mitzvah, right? However, that leads us, in addition to the question of the question then stands as to why, with the clothing for the priests here in Parshat Tetzaveh, why now we have this verse that tells me that the clothing has to be beautiful, when we already know that when you do a mitzvah, that you have to be beautiful. And the mitzvah has to be beautiful. And the second part of that, by the way, is that this is actually different from other mitzvot. You know, if I did bring my tefillin to synagogue in a paper bag, I would still fulfill the mitzvah of tefillin. Right? I remember when I was in the army, one year, you know, we decided, a few of us, we wanted to try to build a sukkah, you know, a booth for the festival of Sukkot. And back then, it's not like today, it's a lot better in the army. Back then, nobody was willing to help you, you know, do these things. If you wanted to do it on your own time. So we had a few hours that they gave us, literally the eve of the festival, to see if we could figure out a way to build a sukkah. And we figured out the smallest sukkah that we could halachically build, which was maybe, I don't know, 2.5 feet, maybe 3 feet high. And technically it is a sukkah, and you could, we stuck it in the back of the dining hall, you know, because there was a place where there were three walls jutting out from the building, and we only had to put one piece of cardboard, and we covered it with schach, with like, and technically it was a sukkah. Now it wasn't a sukkah like any of us ever experienced, it wasn't a beautiful sukkah, but it's a sukkah. So it's true that you should make your sukkah beautiful, and it's true that there's a basis, you know, in the Torah to do that, right? Zeke livan ve'u, hitna elefanav, right? Make it beautiful, but if you didn't make it beautiful, you still fulfill the mitzvah. So why is it that with the clothing for the priest, the clothing for the Kohanim, if you don't make them beautiful, you don't fulfill the mitzvah? If your clothing isn't beautiful, if there's a rip or a stain on the clothing, the whole service is null and void. So why is that? So there is one way to look at this that is based really on Reb Chaim. Rav Dessler talks about this. Rav Avigdor Nevenzahl in his Sichot LaSefer Shmot talks about this, which will lead us to a very interesting topic. I think we've discussed in the past that there's an interesting debate regarding mitzvot as to whether or not mitzvot require kavanah, whether they require intent, right? And we actually rule, halachically speaking, technically speaking, mitzvot einan tzrichot kavanah. A mitzvah does not need kavanah. It doesn't need intent. In other words, if you're out for a run one morning and you happen to be jogging by a synagogue and you hear this funny sound and it sounds something like and you don't know that it's a shofar, and you don't know that it's Rosh Hashanah morning. So the question is, do you nonetheless fulfill the mitzvah of listening to the shofar, even though you have no intent to fulfill the mitzvah, you don't even know what the mitzvah is? So we rule that in general, mitzvot einan tzrichot kavanah, mitzvot don't need kavanah. If I eat a piece of matzah and it happens to be the night of Passover, I fulfill the mitzvah to eat matzah on Passover. Right? If I put tefillin on in the morning, but I don't really know what tefillin are, but a Chabad, you know, a Lubavitcher said, why don't you put on tefillin? I fulfill the mitzvah of tefillin. However, it's interesting that when it comes to the story of shofar, that in fact, I do not fulfill the mitzvah of shofar without intent. For that matter, if you pray without intent, at least ab initio to begin with, you don't fulfill the mitzvah. So the question is why? So Reb Chaim Brisker points out that there's a fundamental difference between a mitzvah like shofar, a commandment like shofar, and a mitzvah like eating matzah. And that's because when it comes to shofar, you know, normally you have the fulfillment of the mitzvah, and then you have the intent of the mitzvah. But when it comes to the mitzvah of blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah, the intent is the mitzvah. The whole point of the mitzvah of blowing shofar is that it arouses your intent. That it motivates you, that it inspires you to become a better person, to change your ways, to repent your evil, you know, whatever that might be. So if you have no intent, if there's no meaningful experience, then you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah of shofar, because shofar is the intent. It's not that, you know, I say the words of prayer and then there's the additional component of intent, of kavanah. Kavanah, the intention, is the mitzvah of prayer. And with that in mind, that might help us to understand the whole issue of the clothing in the temple. Because with every other mitzvah, there's the fulfillment of the mitzvah, and then there's the beautification of the mitzvah. Technically speaking, if you buy an etrog, right, and it fulfills certain technical qualifications on the festival of Sukkot, that citrus etrog, you fulfill the mitzvah. But there's the additional beautifying the mitzvah to buy a beautiful etrog. However, when it comes to the clothing, it must be that the reason that when you wear clothing that's ripped or stained, you don't fulfill the mitzvah, that's because there's not a mitzvah to wear clothing, and then a separate mitzvah that the clothing should be beautiful for the priest in the temple. The mitzvah of the big day kahuna of the clothing is to beautify the mitzvah. The whole point of wearing those beautiful clothes was the beautification of the service in the temple. So if I'm wearing those clothes, but they're not beautifying the mitzvah, because they're ripped, or they're torn, or they're stained, then I haven't fulfilled the mitzvah, because that is the mitzvah. Okay? So, that leads us to the question of why. Why is that idea that the mitzvah is the beautification, why is that specific to the temple? Okay? Why is it that specifically in the temple, in the clothing of the Kohanim, do I find the mitzvah whose essence is beautifying my service of God? As opposed to all the other mitzvot in the Torah, where there's the mitzvah and there's beautifying the mitzvah. Okay? So again, just to summarize where we're at, right, before we move ahead, we said that there's a verse that suggests, you know, that the clothing for the Kohanim are lechavod u'letifaret, they're for beauty, right? And we pointed out that if a person wears ugly clothing, ripped, stained, he doesn't fulfill the avoda, the service in the temple that he's doing when he's wearing such clothing. And we explained that in fact the reason that the entire service is null and void is because when it comes to the clothing of the priests in the temple, beautifying the whole idea of the clothing is to beautify the service of God. And the question is, why is it that specifically the clothing of the Kohen is the vehicle wherein we learn, or the mitzvah where we have the idea of beautifying the service of God? Okay? So that's number one. Number two is very interesting. There's something that happens with this mitzvah, with the mitzvah of the bidei kuna, of wearing the clothing. And that is that what makes this mitzvah different from other mitzvot is that it gets a little confusing in terms of what the ikar is and what the tafel is, what the main thrust is, what the essence is, and what's subordinate to it. You know? And this is a very important idea, because very often we get confused. We forget what the point of what we're doing really is, and we get stuck on the details. We get stuck on the minute. We get stuck on those items that really should be less important. You know? This week was my daughter Mayan's 16th birthday, right? Sweet 16. So we have a custom in our family that I learned, you know, growing up from my parents, that whenever it's one of the kids' birthdays, or Dorit's birthday, or mine, whatever, you know, we get all the kids and we plan this, like, secret party. You know, it's either in the middle of the night, or we wake someone up at 5 in the morning. So I got the kids together the night before. Mayan volunteers once a week in an ambulance, so she was out that night, so we got to do all this, and all the kids get together, and they're all writing their birthday cards and making their little chocolate packets and whatever they're going to do. And we figured we'll wake up early, and we'll wake up Mayan at 6 in the morning. And for whatever the reason, Yair, our youngest, our 7-year-old, he just wasn't getting it together when it came to the birthday card. You know, we picked a card for him and he didn't like it, so he tried a different card, and then he started writing a birthday card and he didn't like it. You know, he's a shtickle perfectionist. And finally, it's like 9 o'clock at night, it's time for the kids to go to sleep already, he's past his bedtime. So my wife gave up and said, okay, you know what, enough is enough, you're going to bed. You want to write Mayan up hard, you can wake up early, do it in the morning. He was a little less than thrilled, but okay. So I promised him, the next morning I woke him up a little earlier so he could finish his birthday card. So all the kids come downstairs, and everybody's, you know, written their cards, and we're getting this basket ready, this tray ready to bring up to Mayan, and I've stolen her alarm clock out of her room so that she won't wake up, and we're waiting for Yair to finish his card. And he's, like, painstakingly writing this birthday card. And, you know, after a minute or two, you know, it's 6:05, 6:10, the kids have to get up for school. So, you know, you have this urge to just yell at him, okay, you know what, enough is enough, forget the card, we're just going upstairs. And then you catch yourself, and you say, well, what's the point of this whole exercise? I mean, the whole point of this is that these kids should feel good, and that they should have what to contribute, and there are all sorts of messages that they learn. In other words, if you lose sight of the point of the entire exercise, you get stuck in details which are really subordinate, you know? And the ability to know what's really important, and what's important but subordinate, is a critical factor in everything that we do. And the best example I can think of, actually, is the original mistake, right? Probably the greatest, at least theologically, the greatest, you know, catastrophe in human history, which is the entire story of Adam and Eve, right? I mean, the snake comes along, God tells Adam, you know, Mikol Eitz Hagan Echol Tochel, you can eat from all the trees in the garden, U'me'etz Adat Tovara Lo Tochel Mimenu, but from the tree of knowledge, you can't eat from that tree, because on the day that you will eat from that tree, so you will die, whatever that means. So the snake is trying to tempt Chava, you know, however we understand that story, and the snake says, right, Mikol Eitzagan, right, what does it say? Afki Amar Elokim Lo Tochlu Mikol Eitzagan. And God has said, don't eat from all the trees, right? That's in the beginning of, it's the first pasuk in chapter 3, the first verse in chapter 3 of Genesis, Bereishit. Now, we know that that's not true. God said, you can eat from all the trees, just don't eat from the tree of knowledge. The snake comes along and says, no, 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 you can't eat from all the trees. So Chava, Eve, points out the mistake and says, in fact, that that's not true. Right? U'mipriya eitz asher betocha gan, amar Elokim lo tochlu mimenu. Right? And it's only from the tree that's in the middle of the garden, the tree of knowledge, that God said, you can't eat from it. Right? And that's good. But then Chava adds those famous words, velo tigubo. Lo tochlu mimenu velo tigubo. You can't eat from it and you also can't touch it. Now we know that that's not true. God never said you can't touch the tree. Right? God just said you can't eat from it. So the snake, seizing on this opportunity, according to the Medrash, rabbinic tradition, which need not be literal, it can be an allegory. The Medrash has the snake push Chava, push Eve into the tree. She touches the tree, she sees nothing goes wrong. Presto changeo, now she thinks that she can eat from the tree, and it all goes downhill from there. So the question is, what made Chava say that she also can't touch the tree? Where did that come from? So the Medrash points out that came from Adam. Adam was the one who heard from God that you can't eat from the tree of knowledge. And he was nervous about coming close to the tree that we can't eat from. So he added astringency. And he said, you know what? We're not going to touch that tree. We're not going to go near that tree. But he neglected to tell Chava that there was a fundamental difference between not eating from the tree and not touching the tree, because not eating from the tree was the ikar, that was the essence, that was the point. Not touching the tree, that was just an opportunity to safeguard the point. And because Chava was confused about the primary and the subordinate, well, that changed everything. That changed world history, right? And this is a general malaise that we have today when you really stop to think about it, because people get so stuck sometimes on the stringencies that they lose sight of the point. And I will give you an amazing example that Rav Avigdor points out. And this is a Gemara. It's such a painful Gemara. It's such a difficult Talmudic discussion. And I think it's especially difficult because although you could make a case for saying this is an allegory, given the way that it's written, I actually think this may have happened. So the Gemara in Yuma, and I urge you, if you're one of the people on this phone who has the ability, the capacity to study a piece of Talmud, this is an incredible piece to study. There are so many ethical messages in this piece of Talmud. It's a very short piece. It's on the bottom of Chaf Gimel Lamed Aleph, 23, Folio A, in the Tractate of Yoma, and it says like this, okay? The Avoda, we're almost done. The Avoda, the service in the temple, began early in the morning. One of the Kohanim, you know, who was chosen, the priest, would climb up into a tower on the Temple Mount, which, by the way, you can come and see from Israelite's roof when you come this summer, right? He would climb up high, and he would wait for the sun to rise, for the first rays of sunlight to sort of, you know, burst forth from behind the horizon. And when he would see the first ray of sunlight, right, he would cry out, Barakai, right? The ray has come. And the Kohanim down below, the priest, the young priest, would know that it was time to start the day. So how did they start the day? As soon as they heard him say Barakai, as the sunlight poured across the sky, they would run up the ramp, up the kevesh, leading to the external, to the Mizbeach HaChitzon, to the altar. Okay? And they would get to the top of the altar, and of course they were, you know, the day starts with the morning sacrifice, the Tamid Shel Shachar. However, before you offer the sacrifice, you have to first clean away the ashes from the previous night's sacrificial sort of burning, right? All night the remnants are burned on the altar, and now you have to clear away the ash from the fire that's died out. And there are very deep ideas behind this, the fact that, you know, light begins the day, the fact that the first, you know, sort of preparation for service is running up a ramp, you know, that we have to always be moving forwards and upwards, but that growth has to be gradual. The fact that before I can offer the sacrifice, I have to clean away the refuse. You know, growth begins sometimes by getting rid of our stuff. We have to be willing to clean out the garbage. And there are a lot of messages there. Okay, so the Gemara says there were two Kohanim, there were two priests. I guess they were young, athletic. The ruts and shoving, and they were running, and they were like neck and neck. Right? And as they're running, so one of them sort of enters the four amot, the four, the four cubits of the other, right? And the Kohen who was bumped, and remember this is a big honor to get to the top first to begin the day, so the Kohen who was bumped, so it says, Ma'ase b'shnei Kohanim, there was a case of two Kohanim, of two priests, Shehayu Shnehen Shavin, they were both equal, in other words, they were both just as, you know, each one of them was just as fast as the other, right? And they're running up the kevesh, right? V'ratzin v'olin b'kevesh, they're running up the ramp. Kadam echad mein letoch arba mochel chaveo. So one of them entered the four cubits, in other words, he was catching up, or he was getting ahead. Natal sakin, so the Kohen who was sort of being pushed or overtaken, took a knife, v'takalo b'libo, and he stabbed him in the heart. Can you imagine? They're in the temple. They're running up to perform the ritual of the morning, the essence, immersed in the service of God, and you could stab a person? And not kill a person? So it happened to be that Rabbi Tzadok, who was one of the great Torah scholars of the day, happened to be, he was a Kohen, he happened to be in the temple that day. Amad Rabbi Tzadok, so Rabbi Tzadok stands up al Malot HaOlam, on the steps leading up to the temple. V'yamar Achenu Beit Yisrael, and he said, my brothers, the children of Israel, the house of Israel, Shim'u, listen. And he sort of quotes the case of a body that's found in between two cities, and what to do, and no one knows how he died, and how the leadership of the closest city has to take responsibility, because at the end of the day, if such a thing could happen, and we didn't give him, you know, sort of housing, and we didn't take care of him, we'd bear responsibility. And says Rabbi Tzadok, Anu, Al Mila Viaglarufa, how will we bring this sacrifice? Who will take care of this? Who will take responsibility? Al Ha'ir, or Al Azarot? Right? Is it the city of Jerusalem? Or is it the courtyards of the temple? And the people hear this, these powerful words, Ga'u kola am bivchia. And the entire audience, all of the Jews that are there, begin to sob. They begin to cry hysterically, realizing to what a pit they've fallen. And by the way, this is the period of the end of the Second Temple, and there's a reason that the Second Temple was destroyed. And it's not because of the Romans. The Romans were just the catalyst. We lost the Second Temple because of who we were and who we weren't. Which is very interesting because that's exactly what we're struggling with today. There's so many people who think that the real issue is, you know, the Hamas. Hamas is just a vehicle. We have not gotten our act together again. Then comes the most amazing part of the story. Right? So, Ga'u kol ha'am b'vchia, so the people are all crying. Ba aviv shel tinok. So the father of this young Kohen who's been stabbed, who's lying dead, umitza'ok shi umeparper, he sees that it's still moving. He's not dead yet. The Amar Harehu Kaparatchem, this is your forgiveness. The Adayin Bnei Meparper, you're trying to do tshuva. Meanwhile, my son is not dead yet. The Lo Nitme'a Sakin, and the knife has not become impure. Do you understand this? In other words, a father standing over the body of his son who's been stabbed and is dying. What's on his mind? Is the knife pure? Has the knife become impure because of contact with death? Can we get the knife out of the temple before an unholy vessel ends up in the temple? Now, how do you look at that? Do you say that this father is on such a high level that the sanctity of the temple is more important to him even than the life of his son? What an incredible level. Or do you say that there's something warped? There's something off? If you can be standing over the body, nach, of your son, and what's concerning you are the laws of ritual purity. And the Talmud struggles with this. The Talmud says, is in fact the issue that they weren't stringent enough about the laws of murder, which may mean they weren't stringent enough about the laws of how we treat our fellow human being? Or is it that they were exactly stringent enough, they were completely appropriate when it came to the laws of how to treat your fellow human being? They were just over-stringent in the laws of ritual purity. It was out of focus. So the Talmud actually rules that the issue was that they weren't careful enough about the laws of how I treat my fellow human being, laws that lead eventually to murder. In other words, what's the essence of murder? Murder, if I can murder someone, is because I don't see that they're created in the image of God. Right? So all of the relationships that we have with each other, all of what's called in Hebrew ben adam l'chavero, between man and his fellow, the root of all of that is whether I see, I mean, the, you know, murder is the physical embodiment, but, you know, character assassination is alluded to in the laws of murder as well. And if you can speak ill of another human being, it's because you really don't understand that there's something holy about every human being, that there's a piece of God inside every human being. And that was the issue they had to struggle with, right? So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir years ago, he says an interesting thing. He says, I understand that the conclusion of the Talmud is that they didn't take the laws of murder and character assassination and everything else seriously enough. But what about the other possibility? He says, even if the other possibility was correct, that the laws of ritual purity were taken too seriously, that would also be a huge problem. If I can make of the laws of ritual purity, whether or not a knife is kosher, if I can make that more important than pikuach nefesh, than the lives of my fellow human beings, then something's wrong. Something's off. And the ability to recognize what are the priorities, what are the important things, and how to prioritize, how to put different things into their appropriate place. That's a critical piece in our relationship with each other and in our relationship with Hashem, with God. You know? And it's interesting. You know, it's kind of like if you're running to get a blessing from a Rebbe, which is a beautiful thing to do. But in the process of getting a blessing from a Rebbe, you're elbowing somebody out of the way, right? If you're in a hurry to get to synagogue, right, because you're late for services one weekday morning, and in the process you slam through a puddle and don't realize that you've just drenched a group of kids standing at the bus stop, then you're missing the boat. You know? Imagine that, I don't know, it's your anniversary. And you want to take your wife out for a special dinner, and you have it all planned, and you buy tickets to a show and dinner and everything, and you tell her it's a surprise, and you want to take her out and whatever. And she's taking her time getting ready. And you're starting to get annoyed because you have this whole thing planned. And so finally you yell at her, could you please hurry up, we have to go. Well, what basically happened? You're so busy examining, you know, the knots on the rope that was tied up to the dock, the boat, meanwhile, is sailing away. I mean, if the whole point is to give your wife a special evening to show her how much you love her, if in the process you're yelling at her, what's the point? Right? Et cetera, et cetera. How often do we do this? And that's the essence. And that brings us, by the way, full circle back to the issue of the clothing of the Kohanim. Because what's really happening? Why is it specifically in that mitzvah? Well, what does it mean to serve God in a temple? Like, why do I need a Beit HaMikdash? What, God isn't everywhere? One might suggest that the whole idea of a temple is the ability to create an environment that's so special, that's so unique, that's so inspiring, that you can't help but be in awe of God in such a place. And in fact, this is reflected halachically. Rabbinic decrees do not apply in the temple. You know, I'll give you an example. So, you know, if you're the Orthodox tradition, we have the custom that we don't play instruments on Shabbat. You know, my dad used to say, on Shabbos you don't need a guitar because you got Shabbat, right? Why don't you play instruments? Because you might come to fix them, you know, if the string breaks or if you have to tune it or whatever. So in order to avoid that mistake, which is a problematic thing, so just don't play instruments. But in the temple, right, in the Beit HaMikdash, you would actually be allowed to play instruments on Shabbat. Because, and the question is why? Because you don't need the rabbinic decree. Because when you're in the temple, you're so in awe of where you are, of being in the temple, you couldn't possibly forget and violate a prohibition and fix something that you're not supposed to fix on Shabbat. You know? It's like maybe a person decides that he's not going to curse anymore. Right? So he just, you know, he stubs his toe and he tries to remember not to say whatever he used to say. But if you were standing in front of the Lubavitcher Rebbe and you stubbed your toe, you wouldn't have to worry about it. You couldn't be in the presence of a person like that and curse because you'd be so in awe of the persona. And, you know, I'm you know, notwithstanding whether you're Lubavitch or not, but just as an example, right? And if that's the whole point of the temple, that's why the clothing isn't just a vehicle. It's not just that we're trying to do a mitzvah and let's see if we can make it beautiful. The whole point of the service of the Kohanim, of the clothing that they wear, was to create an atmosphere that was so beautiful, that was so magnificent, that we could learn from it to beautify our mitzvot everywhere else. And that ability to draw those lines, to understand what's really important and what's not, to be able to assess what the goals are of the different things that we do, that's critical when it comes to our relationship with each other and our relationship with God. And I'll give you maybe one last example, which Rav Avigdor Nevenzahl mentions. You know, we're coming up on Purim. And this coming week, right, we're going to read this scroll of Esther, and there's a whole story, and Haman wanted to destroy us, and we were saved. So there's a very interesting thing we read at the end of the Megillah reading. When we're all finished, we sort of remember who the characters are. Baruch Mordechai, Mordechai is blessed. Arur Haman, Haman is cursed. And there's a little line in there, V'gam Charvona Zechul Latov. And Charvona is also remembered well. So the question is, why is Charvona remembered well? Well, he's remembered well because he's the one who suggested, you know what, Haman, bad news, let's hang him up on that tree. And the king accepts his suggestion, and that's a tremendous thing, because once Haman is hung, then the enemies of the Jewish people see that their game is up, and that allows the rest of the story to unfold and the salvation of the Jewish people to occur. Now, don't get me wrong, right? That was a very serious act. I mean, no one knew. We have the benefit of hindsight now. Haman was the second most important person in the kingdom. I mean, he was like the Adolf Eichmann of his day. and comes along Chavona, who's, by the way, a Persian. He's a Persian minister, and he suggests we should hang him on a tree. Well, he doesn't know what Haman's power base is. And Ahasuerus is described, actually, as a weak king. What if Ahasuerus had backed down? What if Haman had blackmail on him? What if Haman had remained in power? Chavona was just signing his death sentence. So that's a significant thing that he did. Which makes you wonder, why doesn't it say Baruch Chavona? It says Baruch Mordechai. Mordechai is blessed. By Chavona it says, oh yeah, he also, we remember him well. That's like when you're at a dinner and you're thanking everybody and then somebody, psst, don't forget George. Say, oh yeah, we'd like to thank George too. You know, George doesn't feel so great because he's two. He's like, yeah, you too. Right? So that's not a nice thing to do, and also Chavona is remembered. So Rav Avigdor points out an amazing thing. Even though we appreciate what Chavona did, just as important as remembering the difference between Haman and Mordechai, and knowing that Haman is to be cursed and Mordechai is to be blessed, it's also important to know the difference between Mordechai and Chavona. Chavona did a wonderful thing, but he's not Mordechai. He's not a prophet. He's not a member of the Sanhedrin. It's important to know the difference. It's important to understand the difference between, a senator who should be respected and you know, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein who's a Torah giant. And our ability to perceive those differences and to maintain those distinctions. So that's one of the valuable lessons of Purim, because Purim everything gets all mixed up. And it gives us a chance to wake up the next morning and consider, do we really have the lines in order? And do we really understand the priorities? And I think the ability to wrap ourselves around this idea and to be able to sort of, you know, create this cognitive realization of what things are really important and what the priorities really are, that may be part of the message of the temple in general. That when we walk into the temple, we have a chance to take a step back and appreciate sort of what the priorities of life really are.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.